Sketches New and Old, Part 1. My Watch. An instructive little tale. My beautiful new watch had run 18 months without losing or gaining, and without breaking any part of its machinery or stopping. I had come to believe it infallible in its judgments about the time of day, and to consider its constitution and its anatomy imperishable. But at last, one night, I let it run down. I grieved about it as if it were a recognized messenger and forerunner of calamity. But by and by I cheered up, set the watch by guess, and commanded my bodings and superstitions to depart. Next day I stepped into the chief jeweler's to set it by the exact time, and the head of the establishment took it out of my hand and proceeded to set it for me. Then he said, "She is 4 minutes slow, regulator once pushing up." I tried to stop him, tried to make him understand that the watch kept perfect time. But no, all this human cabbage could see was that the watch was 4 minutes slow, and the regulator must be pushed up a little, and so, while I danced around him in anguish, and implored him to let the watch alone, he calmly and cruelly did the shameful deed. My watch began to gain. It gained faster and faster day by day. Within the week it sickened to a raging fever, and its pulse went up to 150 in the shade. At the end of 2 months it had left all the timepieces of the town far in the rear, and was a fraction over 13 days ahead of the almanac. It was away into November enjoying the snow, while the October leaves were still turning. It hurried up house rent, bills payable, and such things, in such a ruinous way that I could not abide it. I took it to the watchmaker to be regulated. He asked me if I had ever had it repaired. I said no, it had never needed any repairing. He looked a look of vicious happiness and eagerly pried the watch open, and then put a small dice box into his eye and peered into its machinery. He said it wanted cleaning and oiling, besides regulating come in a week. After being cleaned and oiled, and regulated, my watch slowed down to that degree that it ticked like a tolling bell. I began to be left by trains, I failed all appointments, I got to missing my dinner, my watch strung out 3 days grace to four and let me go to protest, I gradually drifted back into yesterday, then day before, then into last week, and by the comprehension came upon me that all solitary and alone I was lingering along in week before last, and the world was out of sight. I seemed to detect in myself a sort of sneaking fellow feeling for the mummy in the museum, and a desire to swap news with him. I went to a watchmaker again. He took the watch all to pieces while I waited, and then said the barrel was swelled. He said he could reduce it in 3 days. After this the watch averaged well, but nothing more. For half a day it would go like the very mischief, and keep up such a barking and wheezing and whooping and sneezing and snorting, that I could not hear myself think for the disturbance, and as long as it held out there was not a watch in the land that stood any chance against it. But the rest of the day it would keep on slowing down and fooling along until all the clocks it had left behind caught up again. So at last, at the end of 24 hours, it would trot up to the judge's stand all right and just in time. It would show a fair and square average, and no man could say it had done more or less than its duty. But a correct average is only a mild virtue in the watch, and I took this instrument to another watchmaker. He said the king bolt was broken. I said I was glad it was nothing more serious. To tell the plain truth, I had no idea what the king bolt was, but I did not choose to appear ignorant to a stranger. He repaired the king bolt, but what the watch gained in one way it lost in another. It would run a while and then stop a while, and then run a while again, and so on, using its own discretion about the intervals. And every time it went off it kicked back like a musket. I patted my breast for a few days, but finally took the watch to another watchmaker. He picked it all to pieces, and turned the ruin over and over under his glass, and then he said there appeared to be something the matter with the hair trigger. He fixed it, and gave it a fresh start. It did well now, except that always at 10 minutes to 10 the hands would shut together like a pair of scissors, and from that time forth they would travel together. The oldest man in the world could not make head or tail of the time of day by such a watch, and so I went again to have the thing repaired. This person said that the crystal had got bent, and that the mainspring was not straight. He also remarked that part of the works needed half-soling. He made these things all right, and then my timepiece performed unexceptionably, save that now and then, after working along quietly for nearly 8 hours, everything inside would let go all of a sudden and begin to buzz like a bee, and the hands would straightway begin to spin round and round so fast that their individuality was lost completely, and they simply seemed a delicate spider's web over the face of the watch. She would reel off the next 24 hours in 6 or 7 minutes, and then stop with a bang. I went with a heavy heart to one more watchmaker, and looked on while he took her to pieces. Then I prepared to cross-question him rigidly, for this thing was getting serious. The watch had cost $200 originally, and I seemed to have paid out $2,000 or $3,000 for repairs. While I waited and looked on, I presently recognized in this watchmaker an old acquaintance, a steamboat engineer of other days, and not a good engineer, either. He examined all the parts carefully, just as the other watchmakers had done, and then delivered his verdict with the same confidence of manner. He said, "She makes too much steam, you want to hang the monkey wrench on the safety valve." I brained him on the spot, and had him buried at my own expense. My Uncle William, now deceased, alas, used to say that a good horse was a good horse until it had run away once, and that a good watch was a good watch until the repairers got a chance at it. And he used to wonder what became of all the unsuccessful tinkers, and gunsmiths, and shoemakers, and engineers, and blacksmiths, but nobody could ever tell him. Political economy. Political economy is the basis of all good government. The wisest men of all ages have brought to bear upon this subject the... Here I was interrupted and informed that a stranger wished to see me down at the door. I went and confronted him, and asked to know his business, struggling all the time to keep a tight rein on my seething political economy ideas, and not let them break away from me or get tangled in their harness. And privately I wish the stranger was in the bottom of the canal with a cargo of wheat on top of him. I was all in a fever, but he was cool. He said he was sorry to disturb me, but as he was passing he noticed that I needed some lightning rods. I said, "Yes, yes, go on, what about it?" He said there was nothing about it, in particular nothing, except that he would like to put them up for me. I am new to housekeeping, have been used to hotels and boarding houses all my life. Like anybody else of similar experience, I try to appear, to strangers, to be an old housekeeper. Consequently I said in an offhand way that I had been intending for some time to have 6 or 8 lightning rods put up, but the stranger started, and looked inquiringly at me, but I was serene. I thought that if I chanced to make any mistakes, he would not catch me by my countenance. He said he would rather have my custom than any man's in town. I said, "All right," and started off to wrestle with my great subject again, when he called me back and said it would be necessary to know exactly how many points I wanted put up, what parts of the house I wanted them on, and what quality of rod I preferred. It was close quarters for a man not used to the exigencies of housekeeping, but I went through creditably, and he probably never suspected that I was a novice. I told him to put up 8 points, and put them all on the roof, and use the best quality of rod. He said he could furnish the plain article at 20 cents a foot, coppered, 25 cents, zinc-plated spiral twist, at 30 cents, that would stop a streak of lightning any time, no matter where it was bound, and render its errand harmless and its further progress apocryphal. I said apocryphal was no slouch of the word, emanating from the source it did, but, philology aside, I liked the spiral twist and would take that brand. Then he said he could make 250 feet answer, but to do it right, and make the best job in town of it, and attract the admiration of the just and the unjust alike, and compel all parties to say they never saw a more symmetrical and hypothetical display of lightning rods since they were born, he supposed he really couldn't get along without 400, though he was not vindictive, and trusted he was willing to try. I said, "Go ahead and use 400, and make any kind of a job he pleased out of it, but let me get back to my work." So I got rid of him at last, and now, after half an hour spent in getting my train of political economy thoughts coupled together again, I am ready to go on once more. Richest treasures of their genius, their experience of life, and their learning. The great lights of commercial jurisprudence, international confraternity, and biological deviation, of all ages, all civilizations, and all nationalities, from Zoroaster down to Horace Greeley, have... Here I was interrupted again, and required to go down and confer further with that lightning rod man. I hurried off, boiling and surging with prodigious thoughts swooned in words of such majesty that each one of them was in itself a straggling procession of syllables that might be 15 minutes passing a given point, and once more I confronted him, he so calm and sweet, I so hot and frenzied. He was standing in the contemplative attitude of the Colossus of Rhodes, with one foot on my infant tuberose, and the other among my pansies, his hands on his hips, his hat brim tilted forward, one eye shut and the other gazing critically and admiringly in the direction of my principal chimney. He said now there was a state of things to make a man glad to be alive, and added, "I leave it to you if you ever saw anything more deliriously picturesque than 8 lightning rods on one chimney?" I said I had no present recollection of anything that transcended it. He said that in his opinion nothing on earth but Niagara Falls was superior to it in the way of natural scenery. All that was needed now, he verily believed, to make my house a perfect balm to the eye, was to kind of touch up the other chimneys a little, and thus add to the generous coup d'oeil a soothing uniformity of achievement which would allay the excitement naturally consequent upon the coup d'etat. I asked him if he learned to talk out of a book, and if I could borrow it anywhere? He smiled pleasantly, and said that his manner of speaking was not taught in books, and that nothing but familiarity with lightning could enable a man to handle his conversational style with impunity. He then figured up an estimate, and said that about 8 more rods scattered about my roof would about fix me right, and he guessed 500 feet of stuff would do it, and added that the first 8 had got a little the start of him, so to speak, and used up a mere trifle of material more than he had calculated on 800 feet or along there. I said I was in a dreadful hurry, and I wished we could get this business permanently mapped out, so that I could go on with my work. He said, I could have put up those 8 rods, and marched off about my business, some men would have done it. But no, I said to myself, this man is a stranger to me, and I will die before I'll wrong him. There ain't lightning rods enough on that house, and for one I'll never stir out of my tracks till I've done as I would be done by, and told him so. Stranger, my duty is accomplished, if the recalcitrant and deplogistic messenger of heaven strikes you there, now, there, I said, put on the other 8 at 500 feet of spiral twist, do anything and everything you want to do, but calm your sufferings, and try to keep your feelings where you can reach them with a dictionary. Meanwhile, if we understand each other now, I will go to work again. I think I have been sitting here a full hour this time, trying to get back to where I was when my train of thought was broken up by the last interruption, but I believe I have accomplished it at last, and may venture to proceed again. Wrestled with this great subject, and the greatest among them have found it a worthy adversary, and one that always comes up fresh and smiling after every throw. The great Confucius said that he would rather be a profound political economist than chief of police. Cicero frequently said that political economy was the grandest consummation that the human mind was capable of consuming, and even our own Greeley had said vaguely but forcibly that political. Here the lightning rod man sent up another call for me. I went down in a state of mind bordering on impatience. He said he would rather have died than interrupt me, but when he was employed to do a job, and that job was expected to be done in a clean, workmanlike manner, and when it was finished and fatigue urged him to seek the rest and recreation he stood so much in need of, and he was about to do it, but looked up and saw at a glance that all the calculations had been a little out, and if a thunderstorm were to come up, and that house, which he felt a personal interest in, stood there with nothing on earth to protect it but 16 lightning rods, let us have peace. I shrieked. Put up 150. Put some on the kitchen. Put a dozen on the barn. Put a couple on the cow. Put one on the cook. Scatter them all over the persecuted place till it looks like a zinc-plated, spiral-twisted, silver-mounted canebrake. Move. Use up all the material you can get your hands on, and when you run out of lightning rods put up ramrods, cam rods, stair rods, piston rods, anything that will pander to your dismal appetite for artificial scenery, and bring respite to my raging brain and healing to my lacerated soul. Wholly unmoved further than to smile sweetly, this iron being simply turned back his wristbands daintily, and said he would now proceed to hump himself. Well, all that was nearly 3 hours ago. It is questionable whether I am calm enough yet to write on the noble theme of political economy, but I cannot resist the desire to try, for it is the one subject that is nearest to my heart and dearest to my brain of all this world's philosophy. Economy is heaven's best boon to man. When the loose but gifted Byron lay in his Venetian exile, he observed that, if it could be granted him to go back and live his misspent life over again, he would give his lucid and unintoxicated intervals to the composition, not of frivolous rhymes, but of essays upon political economy. Washington loved this exquisite science. Such names as Baker, Beckwith, Judson, Smith, are imperishably linked with it, and even Imperial Homer, in the 9th book of the Iliad, has said, Fiat justitia, ruat coelum, post mortem unum, ante bellum, hic facit hoc, ex parte res, politicam economico est. The grandeur of these conceptions of the old poet, together with the felicity of the wording which clothes them, and the sublimity of the imagery whereby they are illustrated, have singled out that style.